Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Joining us on the show this week is identity theft expert Robert Siciliano. Robert has some very important tips about how to protect yourself against people stealing your PIN codes and personal information. He even explains why you should be using your credit card as opposed to your debit card on a daily basis. We then chat with our social media intern, John Gordon, about viral videos and how they came to be and why they are the coolest craze on the internet. We hear from our music editor, Sharon Hyland, about new albums on the way, and then from dance music producer, Sterling Void.
Capture your need for sound.
With so much fraud and security breaches happening all over the world, how safe is our personal information? Ever wonder what more you can do to protect yourself from identity theft? Security analyst and author Robert Siciliano joins us to talk about things you can do to protect yourself and what you should be watching out for. Robert, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you so much.
Robert, when it comes to giving out personal information, where should you be drawing the line?
Great question. And the problem is that we pretty much have to give out our data everywhere in order to get products and services. I mean, you want to buy something online, you got to give out your credit card. You want to get health insurance, you got to give out your Social Security number. You want to apply for a new loan, again, Social Security number. I think what it boils down to is recognizing what the risks are, and when you're put into situations where you have to give up this data, determine if it's worth the risk. For example, if somebody says, if you walk into a hardware store, national chain, and they say, we will give you 10% off everything in the store today if you sign up for instant credit. And so that means you've got to give this guy who's wearing work boots and a ripped T-shirt your Social Security number for 10% off a tool. Now, in that scenario, is that guy going to be responsible with your personal information? I don't think it's worth the 10% off. In other situations where you have, insurance, that you have to give your family, life insurance, health insurance, and so forth, and you're going to give up your social, then, it's worth it. But there are things that you can do, ultimately, to make that data useless to the thief. So recognizing what the risks are, determining, the value proposition, is it worth the risk, and then, again, knowing how to protect yourself.
What's your thoughts on PayPal, Robert? Because I know, a friend of mine, he sort of got me onto that, and he'd had a bad experience, and PayPal, not with PayPal, but with a company, and PayPal actually saved him and helped him out and got his money back.
So I like PayPal. I'm a big fan. I use them quite frequently, actually. They know what they're doing. They have their ducks in a row. They have their security in place. They also have additional measures. So if you're using PayPal from a device that PayPal is not familiar with, they'll send out some type of a notification via email or via text to let you know that there's a transaction taking place. And they might ask you to do something in addition to verify that if you, in fact, are conducting that particular transaction. I do like PayPal. What you have to watch out for is not PayPal itself, but emails that look like they're coming from PayPal that we receive that are designed to get us to cough up our personal information, like our usernames and passwords, and sometimes our credit card numbers. Those are, of course, phishing emails or smishing emails that we might get via text message. So phish, of course, is email, smish is text. And we get them, and it looks like, or it says it's coming from PayPal, but in fact, it's fake, designed to get you to plug in your information. Just be aware of them. PayPal certainly is aware of it, and they will tell you just the same, just to hit delete and maybe even let them know that they received one of these phish or smish communications.
I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to ask you something. I would say about 6 or 8 months ago, I got an email, one of those phishing emails from someone pretending to be my bank. And right away I knew it was, false or whatever. And I actually reported it to my bank and they didn't seem to care. Do you hear about that often where the institution doesn't seem to care?
Yeah, they're so inundated and overwhelmed with fraud. Their brands, your bank, AOL, PayPal, most major credit card companies, I mean, everybody. So if you have an online presence, chances are your business and your business's clients have been targeted for fraud using legitimate brand names that we as consumers know, like, and trust. And so if you were targeted, chances are thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of other people were also targeted. So you can imagine the deluge of information that they're getting from their clients, their customers, that, you know, this has taken place. And after a while, they're like, yeah, we know. So, yes, it's a good idea to let them know, but chances are they probably already know anyways.
I think a lot of us, you know, sort of live our lives in our own little bubble, and we're a little hokey pokey and don't really always think that there's bad guys in every corner, which is fine on some level, but then others not good. How easy is it for someone to actually clone your Visa or debit card? Because I think a lot of us just like, boop, put it in, give me my money, boop, like, do my transaction. They don't think about that stuff.
Yeah, I wish I could live in a bubble all hokey pokey. You know, I just wish that was my life. Unfortunately, I know too much. You know, cloning your card is as easy as burning a CD. For example, you use your card, a credit card, at a gas station, at a restaurant, at an ATM, and when you hand it over or when you swipe it, there's technology readily available that allows a criminal to copy your the information off of the magnetic strip, to clone that card. Whether it's an ATM skimmer or the waiter-waitress gas station attendant has a skimming device by hand, they just simply copy the information off the back of the magnetic strip, and they take it back to their, you know, boiler room operation. They download the data, and they just burn it like burning a CD onto a blank credit or debit card, and then they'll go ahead and make unauthorized charges, either, you know, at a self-checkout or make a withdrawal at an ATM, especially if they've got your PIN code as a result of ATM skimming, which usually involves a skimming device along with a small wireless camera that records your PIN as you type it in. So it's really important to prevent skimming, to cover up the keypad with your other hand as you're punching in your PIN code so that additional camera doesn't see your PIN code. And when it comes to your credit and debit card, just pay very close attention to your statements refuting any unauthorized charges. Generally, by law, within 60 days, I recommend, you know, within one billing cycle, but even going online every couple of weeks to look at your statements.
Can I ask you to, I suppose, either confirm or deny this? Like, I've heard that it's safer if you are using your credit card as opposed to your debit card, like if you are at the gas station, if you are whatever, at a restaurant, for these skimming purposes. Is that true or does it matter?
I confirm. I do not use a debit card out in the wild, meaning that I don't use a debit card like a credit card or like a check card. I don't use a debit card at the grocery store or the gas station. I only use a debit card at my bank branch to make deposits and occasionally to take out cash or to verify me in front of the teller. But I don't use it for everyday transactions. The more you use it, the more at risk it is. And the problem with a debit card is that if it is in fact compromised, then the money taken out of the account is actually your cash, which is a problem. Whereas if it's the credit card that's compromised, it's the credit card company's money. And then, you know, money taken out of your bank account via fraud, you end up bouncing checks. Now, here's the thing. By federal law, here in the U.S. at least, we have 60 days to refute unauthorized charges on a credit card. But with a debit card, with a bank card, it's only a couple of days. And I'm pretty sure that it's similar in Canada as well. So that being said, I don't use a debit card because, you know, it's direct access to my bank account. I just use credit and rack up all kinds of points as well.
I'm so glad that you set that straight, Robert, because I think there's a lot of us out there. Like, I've recently switched to mainly doing the credit card thing, and I'm glad that what I have decided to do is actually the thing to do. Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show right now, a security analyst and author of 99 Things You Wish You Knew Before Your Identity Was Stolen, Robert Siciliano. Make sure you check out his website, robertsiciliano.com. Do the PIN codes on, you know, Visas or MasterCards and debits, like, really help, Robert?
The U.S., we just have the magnetic stripe cards, and they're old, antiquated technology, whereas in Mexico and in Canada, everyone's migrating to what's called the EMV, or Euro Mas- MasterCard Visa, also known as chip and PIN. And chip and PIN is much, much more secure than the regular magnetic stripe cards in the U.S. So when a PIN is involved, that is in addition to a chip, a computer chip that's built into the card itself, much harder to clone, much harder to copy, and much more secure. Canada and Mexico, they know what they're doing as far as, you know, most of the European nations, they've pretty much all migrated to chip and PIN. And here in the U.S., we're just, for whatever reason, 5 years behind everybody else.
Are you surprised by this? Like, I'm surprised that the states are behind. Like, you'd think they'd be leading the charge.
Yeah, you know what it is? It has a lot to do with there are a number of technologies out there that may leapfrog chip and PIN. It's been said over and over again that mobile will leapfrog chip and PIN, and that we may never go to chip and PIN. But, you know, it's become painfully obvious that we're going to have to go chip and PIN. The U.S. has been holding out for quite some time, and they've been suffering as a result. I mean, there's still a tremendous amount of fraud out there.
I wanted to ask you about this as well. Like, you know, I just recently had to go get my driver's license and my health card sort of updated, and so, you know, you're getting your picture taken and signing on that sort of dotted line, which they then burn onto your new identification. Does that photo ID and that signature mean anything, Robert?
Your vulnerable data ultimately is either your social security number or your social insurance number, your credit card information, but with that, you're paying attention to your statement, refuting it. Your picture is available. It's out there. It's online. It's in social. Your signature is a false sense of security. It has no really security value whatsoever. As far as the signature itself goes, it's just scribbly lines on a piece of paper. We've been using it since the days of, you know, kings and queens and kingdoms and moats and dragons and wizards and everything else, and it's a total false sense of security that has no proactive security value whatsoever. So if somebody copies your signature, really in the end, all that does, you know, to a handwriting analysis expert via the bank, is to assign liability when there's loss, and usually it's the bank that'll eat it.
Okay. Now, I wanted to ask you about this. I actually have a friend that is still in university, and she sent me an email, and at the bottom was her student ID, and I called her on it right away. I was like, why are you sending out emails with your student card number? And she's like, oh, well, one of the professors told us that to communicate we needed to do that. And I was like, are you stupid? I'm like, that's just a gateway for them to get to your personal identity. And so what do you think about university and college kids, you know, just banding about their student ID number?
So it all depends. Each account that we let out of the bag, right, that we expose publicly, is one more piece of information that the bad guy can use against us. And so, for example, with that student ID, that, you know, somebody who's, you know, nefarious-minded could go ahead and use that to open up, say, certain accounts within the university that might get tagged to the student's account that might involve a credit card or some type of payment that might be required. That may or may not be the case. Every university might be a little different. But that being said, you know, whether it's your credit card, again, Social Security, Social Insurance, student ID, driver's license number, even a phone number for that matter is an account number. Every little bit of data that we let out there that we make public that is just more ammunition for a criminal to use against us to open new accounts under our names or to take over existing accounts that we're responsible for. So, you know, the more obscure you are with account information, the better off you are in the long run.
Joining us on the show is security analyst and author of 99 Things You Wish You Knew Before Your Identity Was Stolen, Robert Siciliano. Again, for more information, go to his website, robertsiciliano.com. What's your thoughts on social media, Robert? I feel you're going to have some thoughts on that, some strong thoughts.
So social media is today what, you know, back in the day, like the KGB was, you know, back in the 50s and 60s with the Cold War. We were all concerned about, you know, Russian criminals and Russian agents infiltrating and being the mole on the inside of the organization, you know, infiltrating the government and the corporation. Today, the mole on the inside is us and it's social media. We're giving away all the data. We're giving away everything the bad guy needs to become us, to take over our existing accounts, to get access to our friends, our families, our employees, our employers, where we live, where we vacation, where we are, and where we aren't. And that's a problem. We're exposing way too much in that regard. And if people talk about wanting their privacy, but then they give out all this information about them and where they are and so forth, you know, privacy at this point essentially has been decimated as a result of social media and other ways in which we expose it. All that being said, keeping in mind that, you know, at any given point in time, somebody who you may not want to watch may be watching, paying unwanted attention, and gathering and taking notes of, you know, what it is that you're doing and who you're with and, you know, information about you. And one big risk about that is, for example, when you go to reset a password on a particular account, like you, if you forget the password, you often click a link that requires you to answer all kinds of knowledge-based questions. And the answer to those knowledge-based questions may eventually get you your password or get you a new password. And the answers to those knowledge-based questions can often be found on the web via social media. For example, Sarah Palin, that's how her email, her Yahoo account was hacked. Bad guy just hit the forget password link and went ahead and answered, you know, who her high school sweetheart was, where she met him, where she likes to vacation, and so on and so forth, and eventually, you know, hacked her Yahoo account.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's crazy. Well, that's good. Yeah. Very good to know. And, you know, for people out there right now that are listening to this, if you suspect someone has stolen your identity, what is the first step to do, and where do you go? What do you do?
So very first thing is to contact the credit bureaus, and with the credit bureaus, you initiate a well, this is all in regards to new account fraud. So if it's new account fraud where they open up new accounts under your name, you want to basically lock down your social as it appears on your credit report. So it's your credit report that has been essentially compromised when somebody opens up like a new line of credit, they get a new credit card, they get a new mobile phone, and you want to get a fraud alert. A fraud alert will alert a creditor that your identity could have potentially been compromised. And I think in Canada, the option to get a credit freeze may exist. I know in the States it does. And a credit freeze basically locks down your credit so that nobody can open up any new accounts under your name at all. That's to prevent new account fraud. As far as any other forms of account takeover, you know, credit cards compromised and so forth, bank account compromise. You always want to contact the organization responsible for that account and go through their process to restore your good name, to basically reset the clock to make you whole again. And every organization has their own way of doing things.
Is identity theft, you know, something that can be easily avoided?
Well, as long as you have proper systems in place, for example, I work with McAfee, and of course we encourage antivirus, anti-spyware, anti-phishing, and a firewall. As long as you have that on your devices, including your mobile devices, along with updating your operating systems, critical security patches, making sure you have protected Wi-Fi, and protected Wi-Fi means, you know, your wireless connection to the internet at home or at the office or when you're out and about is protected. One program you can get is called Hotspot Shield. It's a free VPN, virtual private network, that you can use on any wireless device, Android, iPhone, a laptop, to connect to the internet, basically protecting your wireless connection. Again, it's called Hotspot Shield. Again, it's free. Check that out online. You want to just do all all these systems in place, layers of protection, to make it that much more difficult for the bad guy to choose you as their next target.
Okay, and what's the one thing you want to put in our heads right now, you know, as we head out into the world again tomorrow? Like, what is the one thing that we really need to be aware of?
Certainly, you know, fundamentally, it's up your security intelligence. Like, this has been a great opportunity for your listeners to get the fundamentals down. And if you exercise the fundamentals and every day you're conscious of your security, knowing that, you know, there always has been, is, and always will be this criminal element out there, and they're always looking for an opportunity, and you have all these systems in place to prevent them from choosing you, then you're going to be in that much better shape.
Robert, you're awesome. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
That was security analyst Robert Siciliano. Again, for more information on his book and more tips on safeguarding your identity, check out his website, robertsiciliano.com.
Capture your need for sound.
Taking a look at what is going on in the world of music is our music editor, Sharon Hyland.
Hey, thanks, Kel. It's been a while, right? So let's start with the good stuff. Not that eye candy can be heard, but for fans of Tim McGraw, Two Lanes of Freedom marks a 5-year clean and sober slate, along with ripped abs. You know that if he can make a t-shirt look that good, he's doing something right. We've already heard One of Those Nights and Truck Yeah, and I'd bet that Highway Don't Care won't be too far off as it features Taylor Swift and Keith Urban. A few other things to look forward to during the winter wind down. A documentary put together by Dave Grohl called Sound City digs into the human element of the now closed recording studio of the same name. Grohl chats with all kinds of artists that recorded there over the years, including Stevie Nicks, John Fogerty, and a ton more. The soundtrack brings a lot of those rockers together, and both DVD and CD will be available by the first half of March. And nice to hear from Dido again, too, whose Girl Who Got Away, her fourth album, and there's some electronica happening on that, but a great compliment to her haunting vocals. It's an even dozen studio albums for Jersey Boys Bon Jovi with What About Now, and the Because We Can tour, named after the first single, already underway, marks the first time the band have toured before the record was released. Some call that unconventional, while others remember that fans are usually more eager to hear the hits than the new stuff anyway. Mid-March will be busy with great big returns. David Bowie gave us a taste of his 24th album just a few weeks ago with a song called Where Are We Now, the first single from The Next Day, his first collection of new music in 10 years. Justin Timberlake wasn't on as long a break as Bowie was, but after a few years pursuing some roles in films and other roles like becoming the husband of Jessica Alba, JT is back with his branding on that soulful groove that harkens back to a classic style of R&B that not only allows me to say, hearken, but also, thanks to Suit and Tie, the first single, it has us in high falsetto anticipation of the 2020 experience. Will.i.am. At last check, the fourth album outside of the Black Eyed Peas had pushed back a few times, actually, since last March. So one full year later, and hashtag willpower could very well be called hashtag better late than never. A little bit further down the road, OneRepublic, The Strokes, Cher, and Mariah Carey will have new releases along with NKOTB. That's what the cool kids call them. And OMD. The even cooler kids don't need an explanation on that one. See you next time.
I can't wait till I get you on the floor good looking. Hey, going hot, so hot, just like an oven. And I'll burn myself, but just had to touch it. But it's so fine, and it's all mine. Hey, baby. As long as I got my suit and tie, I won't leave it out on the floor tonight. And you got fixed up to the nines, let me show you a few things. All pressed up in black and white, and you're dressed in that dress I like. Love is swinging in the air tonight, let me show you a few things. Let me show you a few things. Show you a few things all about love. Now we're in the swing of love, let me show you a few things. Show you a few things.
Let me get a good look at it. Ooh, so thick. Now I know what they call it, a fatty. And oh, shit, so sick. Got a hit and picked up a habit. That's all right.
Social media at all, you will have heard of viral videos. It seems these little videos are definitely the cool kids at the party. Joining us on the show to explain how and where they came from is one of the Kelly Alexander Show's social media interns, John Gordon. John, thanks for hanging out with us on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So here is the deal. What is a viral video and what does it mean when a video actually goes viral? Because, I mean, viral videos have been around for like, you know, a hot minute now, but I think we don't really know where or when it came from.
Right. Well, a simple definition of a viral video is basically it becomes popular through the process of internet sharing. And the way these videos get shared on the internet is either through social media, blogs, websites, or even by email. And what's also important to note is that a viral video, meaning which is gains popularity, it doesn't matter whether it has 50,000 views or 50 million views. It's just the fact that it gets spread around to so many different areas of the internet, like I said, blogs, websites, and that's what makes it viral. So, of course, the word viral, that has to do with the whole term of virus and how it gets spread around. So that's where that came from.
Okay. And a question for you, because, you know, if anyone sort of watches the Ellen DeGeneres Show, which a lot of people do, obviously, she seems to get interested quite a bit in YouTube videos. And it always, you know, feels like if she watches a video and it gets airtime on her show, it seems to go viral from there. So would you say that other shows of her stature provide like a marketing platform, if you will, for viral videos?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, this leads into the next point, which there's three reasons why videos become viral. And this is specifically on YouTube. According to Kevin Alaka, he's a trends manager for YouTube. The first reason that videos become viral is because of tastemakers like Ellen DeGeneres, who basically introduce us to these new and interesting things, and they bring them to the audience. And so because these tastemakers are exposing us and they have such a large influence on us, these videos get such great exposure, thus allowing them to go viral.
And then you said there's two other areas that help push it?
Yeah, and the two others basically are there's something called communities of participation. And that's just when these videos become so big that it also allows for them to be remixed. And I think the best example right now to this day of a video being remixed is, of course, the Harlem Shake,
right,
which is just absolutely huge. I'm sure. Have you seen it?
I've actually been part of one.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So, like I said, it was remixed. It's actually just an interesting fact. The Harlem Shake was released on February 2nd, and since then, it has had 50,000 remixes and over 200 million views of all these remixes. So it's just been absolutely huge.
Wow, that's really good. And that is like the viral video of the moment, if we'll sort of say.
Right. So what's important to note about that is that we don't just enjoy these videos now; is that we're also able to participate in them. So that's a really important thing to note. And the third thing is unexpectedness. So what I mean by this is that in a typical day, and actually, yeah, and basically on YouTube, in 2 minutes, over 72 hours of videos are uploaded on YouTube. And in order for, you know, videos to stick out, they need to be unexpected and they need to be spontaneous. So that's basically the third way. You're not going to guarantee that your video goes viral, but it gives you the edge of having the video, you know, become popular.
And then I'm guessing, like, in that, which you've probably already explained, but I guess when people share, obviously, like, if, you know, you think it's cool and you share it, then you're already opening up that network to all of your, you know, either Facebook friends or Twitter friends and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then it obviously continues the viralness of it.
Right, yeah. I mean, just like in this day and age with all the different social media and how huge they are, it just makes it so much more easier for these videos to just become so popular.
Now, how do you explain videos going viral on other platforms? Like, do they, or is it really YouTube? Is that sort of the be-all and end-all?
Right. Well, of course, like I said, YouTube is the big one. There are other ways to share videos. Another example that I want to use of how videos go viral is Psy's Gangnam Style,
okay,
which, of course, was another huge viral video. And I actually got this information from a PR agency called 10 Yetis, and they have six ways in which a video can go viral. The first one is to have a final goal in mind. So for Gangnam Style, YG Entertainment, that's the record label / talent agency in South Korea, and they were in charge of putting this video out. They had a goal in mind, how many likes they want, how many shares they want. So they had this all planned out in the beginning, and that's really important for all videos, I think, at least for a lot of videos, if they want to become viral.
Okay.
Yeah, and then the second point is to grow a large audience or followers. And once again, going back to Gangnam Style, YG Entertainment, they already had 2.5 million subscribers to their various YouTube channels, and they had over 1.6 billion views for all their videos. So they already had the audience. And on the first day that Gangnam Style was released, it had 500,000 views. So obviously, wow, it was off to a great start.
Wow, that's amazing. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Joining us on the show right now is our social media intern, John. You can actually follow him on Twitter at John_G87. So what was your other point there, John?
Yeah, so those are the first 2 points of how videos can go viral. Third point is basically creating content that is engaging and shareable among all the different boundaries. So I guess you can go back to, you know, getting to the Harlem Shake, just being able to remix it, but also being able to share all these videos like Gangnam Style through different areas like email, blogs, all that. The fourth one is teasing to known fanatics and early adopters. So in case of YG Entertainment, they actually sent out tweets from their K-pop account that had a lot of followers already, just letting them know, you know, what's going to happen. So people were, you know, anticipating something big. So that was huge. Fifth point is to have a plan to reignite the video along the way. And this is where media comes to play, and it's really important. So as you mentioned before about Ellen being,
yeah,
really important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so like I said, she's a tastemaker. She has a lot of influence. So when Psy actually appeared on Ellen for the first time, he gained a lot of recognition, and so much so that he actually returned to her show a week later, and he also appeared with Britney Spears. And in return, Britney Spears tweeted about Psy, and of course, she has a big following. So it's kind of like you can kind of notice it's like a cycle, how...
Like a domino effect.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that's fantastic. That's really great to know. And I wanted to ask you this as well. How do people benefit from viral videos?
They can benefit in many different ways in terms of, you know, Psy's case. He gained a lot of exposure. He was famous and big in South Korea, but of course he wanted to gain exposure to, I think, the whole world, which he definitely did. Another way that people can benefit from videos is, you know, they can actually make a living doing this, specifically on YouTube. You know, people put out tons of videos, and the more views they get, the more money they could actually make off of the advertisements. Also, another important benefit is that you're able to send out a message to the entire world, whatever that message is, it can get out there and it could really impact people.
And I'm assuming that, like, almost if we take the Justin Bieber effect, like, you know, he wasn't a viral video, but, you know, he put himself out there with his own sort of covers of songs, and he almost became a viral sensation anyways, because that's how he got going, and then his brand was started. And so I'm assuming if you put out a video that does go viral, you can increase your brand awareness for sure, and even brand equity, I would think.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, like you said, yeah, Justin Bieber, he started on YouTube, which I think some people don't realize. His YouTube His name, I think, was called Kid Rawl, and he was just discovered by his current agent, Scooter Braun. From there, Usher, the singer, of course, saw his stuff on YouTube, and he signed him. So, yeah, definitely YouTube or any video sharing website now definitely allows people to, you know, become famous or pursue their dreams.
Do you think that you need to be super creative to create a viral video?
Yes and no. I would say yes, because, you know, that can help you stand out. There are instances where being creative, you know, definitely did help. I think going back again to Gangnam Style, they were very creative. They used very vibrant, bright colors, a very catchy tune. And they also actually, what a lot of people don't realize is the people that, the other characters in the video were actually already well known in South Korea. So I think that helped. But on the other side, it doesn't always have to be creative. I mean, just if it's something really kind of plain, simple, the more simple it is, actually sometimes the better, especially also in terms of length. If it's, so let's say for Harlem Shake, it was only 30 seconds long. You know, cause a lot of people don't, some people's attention spans are not that long. So I think simple is the way to go sometimes also.
Do you think viral videos are a trend that's going to stay around, or do you think that, you know, eventually it'll fade away? Like, I'm just wondering if this is here to stay for a bit.
I mean, of course, it's right now it's huge. I think in the future it'll stay. It may change in the sense that maybe being able to share it on even more on more platforms. I don't know what they'll be, but I think definitely YouTube, I think, will be around for a long time, and I think this will allow even more people to, you know, gain recognition. And I think this also will work it'll work in favor of many companies in order to further their message. And just overall, yeah, I think it's definitely here to stay for a while.
Awesome. Well, John, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate you hanging out.
Thank you very much.
That's one of our social media interns here on The Kelly Alexander Show, John Gordon. You can follow him on Twitter at John_G87.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
Hi, I'm Peter Anthony Holder, and I would like you to join me for a very eclectic and different kind of radio show. It's called The Stuff File Program. Where else would you get to hear a well-renowned Hollywood acting teacher, a best-selling science fiction writer, a guy who teaches llamas how to be golf caddies, or the man who has Hitler's toilet, all wrapped up with some of the oddest news stories around? It's a rhetorical question. There's only one place. The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. There are various ways to catch the show. You can find it at my website at thestufffile.com. Check out my blog at peteranthonyholder.blogspot.com. Find it at cyberstationusa.com, kdxradio.com, pcjmedia.com, or simply subscribe to it on iTunes. You've forgotten all those places already, haven't you? Okay, just Google the title. It's called The Stuff File Program, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. Catch it, enjoy it, and have a chuckle or two. The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Radio will never be the same again.
Joining us on the show is a man who loves to make people move with the sounds of his incredible dance music. Sterling Void hails from Chicago and definitely has a Chi-Town feel to his tracks, which have caught the attention of such industry heavyweights like the Pet Shop Boys. Sterling, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
How you doing, Mrs. Kelly? How you doing?
I am fantastic. I'm very excited that you're joining us on the show this week. And to start off, I have to ask you, how did you actually get involved in music? Was it like a childhood dream of yours?
Well, that is a very great question. Well, here in Chicago, back in the day, I used to just be a DJ, and I was DJing at these little local house parties that were in the neighborhood on the south side of Chicago, and they were, what was so amazing about it, they cost $1 to get in them. So what happened was the people who had these parties at their houses in their basement, they'd make these little flyers, what we call pluggers, on index cards, and then you put your name on there being a DJ. So I was like a local neighborhood DJ with my partner, Daryl Reese, which we called ourselves the Wild Pair. We stole that name from a shoe store, which was in the Chicago area, called the Wild Pair. So we started calling ourselves, you know, the Wild Pair DJ guys. But if I can go a little further back, as a kid, by me being the only child, I had you have interesting things. So, like, if my father saw that I wanted to play the guitar. He bought me a guitar. One minute I was going through the drum phase, he bought me some drums. So there's always some type of music instrument in my home, or some type of radio, or back in those days, little turntables. You know, my mom and dad, you know, kind of bought me a lot of things when I was a kid. So a lot of music instruments is always in the home.
How did you figure out that your heart lay in the dance community?
Well, like I said, once, like, after the DJ and stuff, I started really being a club person, because I fell in love with Farley Jackmaster Funk. He was probably one of the hottest DJ idols of all times for me. And I used to go to this club where he was like the king at the playground right here on 13 South Michigan on the south side of Chicago. And I just fell in love with Farley, the way his skills and stuff, what he did. And Jesse Saunders was a DJ there also. And I just fell into, you know, the heart of house music and dance music, and that form started it. And as time went on, I kind of graduated to the Power Plant, which was a huge, not the Power Plant, to the Warehouse where Frankie Knuckles DJ. And then as a couple of years later, Frankie started a new club called the Power Plant. And I just lost my mind in that place. And then some cats were like, hey, man, you've been to the Underground and Lil Wacker Drive in Chicago? And I went there, and that's when I ran into Ron Hardy. And Ron Hardy took me on an adventure. I don't even think I ever came back from that. But from the beginning of house music, far as like, you know, how we used to make them. See, a lot of people don't really know that house music actually really started in Chicago, where we used to have these little drum machines, and we were making this music in the house. So that's where it became house music, because you have a drum machine, then you have a little sampler, and then you might sample a hook or a vocal or something, then you add it to the track, and then, you know, we just start making beats and playing this stuff in the music box, and local DJs will play their little mixes on cassettes, because back in those days, it was a cassette, it wasn't a DVD or CDs were out then. So, you know, then you give it to the local DJ, and then he'll play it, then you become a local celebrity. And next thing you know, these little record companies have landed here in Chicago, which you've probably heard of, DJ International and Chicago Track Records, you know, and it was history from there.
Now, coming from Chicago, it sounds like, you know, your hometown definitely has a lot to play in the music that you produce. Would you say that's true?
Well, you know what? It is. You have some amazing questions. You know what? They do not play my music here. That is so amazing. I think It's All Right was maybe a Chicago hit, street jam hit 1 year when it was kind of booming at the time. But to be honest, DJs don't play my music here. For some reason, they do not play Sterling Void music here in Chicago. My base is more Europe, New York. East Coast plays a lot of my stuff, but my stuff is really banging overseas, more likely. My fan base is more overseas. Now, people here in Chicago, they you know, represent me and respect me as being a legend of the game, but a lot of these DJs here don't really play my stuff, and it's not anything I don't think you take it personally. It's just like when It's All Right was made, they were more into, if you really think back on, like, back in the day when house music was really formed, it was more like house tracks and jack, jack, jack your body, jack, jack, jack your body. And then when Daryl Pandy made Love Can't Turn Around, it kind of changed a lot of the distinctive of house music to having real singers and real lyrics. Now, when It's All Right was written, which Paris Brightledge wrote some of the lyrics, he wrote that some political stuff that took people to start pondering. The lyrics pondered on people's minds. So they was like, wow, these lyrics are so refreshing and uplifting and so positive, but it's along with a house track. Because a lot of people really didn't take house music to the extent that it would do what it did, because it was all about just the beats and maybe a sample loop or something like that. But when Paris Brightledge actually brought those lyrics to the table, it kind of turned house music. It took, well, my distinctive song, It's All Right, to a level where I think people in Europe just, you know, were feeling more of the lyrics and the message of the music at the time, more than what the Chicago fans were doing, more of just stuff to make you really bump and jump around and lose your mind over.
Can you talk to us about your connection to the Pet Shop Boys and how that came about?
Well, wow, great. Ooh, you're giving great questions. Now, I got to be honest about this stuff. I don't, you know, if whoever, feet might get hurt by this, but I got to be honest, I never knew that the Pet Shop Boys had picked my song up. Rocky Jones at DJ International was kind of on some flaky stuff back in those days. So I happened to find out from a fan, say, hey, man, I heard your version of the Pet Shop Boys. So I'm like, wow, I never knew that they had picked the song up. And I went to Rocky Jones, which is the president of DJ International, and found out later that the Pet Shop Boys had picked up It's All Right and did a recover of it. Now, as far as how it made me feel great that, you know, a group as, you know, the Pet Shop Boys would pick something up of mine and found something in it that they were enlightened by. It really, you know, made me feel good. But back in those days of working with DJ International Records, I won't fault Rocky Jones and DJs a lot of the problem with far as me and a lot of our artists. One thing about it, we love what we did as artists, and we found that being an artist and people seeing you at the clubs, hey, there go Sterling Void, hey, there go Chip E. We didn't understand the business part about the music business. We knew the music. We were producers. We were DJs. And we were celebrities. And we were, like I said, local celebrities. And we knew that part of the game. But we did not know about the publishing part and the royalties and all that stuff. So we didn't really look at that stuff. So the company made thousands of dollars off a lot of us, and a lot of us didn't really make any money back in those days from our, you know, from our music. But luckily, as time came along, the internet got us opportunities to talk to these people over in other countries and find out about these record companies. And after DJs International kind of went bankrupt, a lot of these companies overseas were looking for us as artists, and they couldn't go through DJs to find us no more. So they started reaching out to people, to the individuals like myself. Like, I really didn't start really getting paid for my music, to be honest, till when was that? Maybe about 8 years ago, from a guy named Mike Morrison, which was over in the UK, was looking for me, and he was like, Sterling Void, I've been a fan of yours for years. I've been looking for you for like about the last 3 years, and luckily Daryl Pandy was the late, rest in peace, Daryl Pandy was a good friend of mine. He happened to know Mike and told Mike, yeah, I know Sterling. He said, I've been looking for Sterling. So what happened was Sterling, they did a re-license deal with my old catalog of It's All Right and Runaway Girl. He got me a publisher. He got me on the way where I started getting my publishing money, starting getting my royalties back. I didn't get everything back from over the years that I'd never got it, but he got me start picking up a lot of my publishing and got me on the right track. So I respectfully give a lot of ups to Mike Morrison. That guy really helped me start learning the music business. And as the years went by, I started doing license deals and making money. And every 90 days I get publishing, well, royalty checks from BMI. And then every 6 months I get my publishing checks from my publisher, which is Peter Stratton. He's over in the UK. So after going through some things, I guess I learned hands-on training on just how the music business is. It really was, you know.
Joining us on the show is DJ and music producer Sterling Void. Sterling, do you have in mind right now like a dream collaboration that you'd like to you know, have happen? Is there an artist right now that's super hot that you would love to work with?
Yes, David Guetta.
Okay.
I would love to work with him. Him and Ron Carroll. I would like to do something with Ron Carroll, which was just in the studio yesterday with my label distributor, Jerry King. They were in the studio. I would love to work with Ron Carroll. But David Guetta, I would love to work with that guy. because of his work he does with the Black Eyed Peas and the Nicki Minaj and all that. So I would love to work with that guy because really that stuff is pop music, but it's, when you really break it down, it's nothing but old, good old house music.
What are you working on now and what can we expect from you in the next couple of months?
Okay, I got a hot single coming out on my label, which is called, yeah, I do have a record label called Void Digital Music, which is on all download sites, TrackSource, Beatport, Amazon, Rhapsody, and iTunes is for sure. But I have a hot track coming out with Javon Showtime Johnson, which is called Dance the Night Away, which is going to be a major hit. I got hot remixes from Superfunk. I got a hot remix from Megabox. And my good friend Rampus has did a good remix on that package. And I got, and I put together like a small EP compilation called Feel the Void. I put some tracks I made back in, about the 1999, I think it was. So these are some unreleased Sterling Void tracks that I put together on an EP called Feel the Void. It's in the stores. TrackSource, I think it's going to be exclusive on TrackSource. And I got, for you UK listeners and your... if you know anything about Angie Brown, the diva Angie Brown, we have a track called Sweet Bitter Loving, which will be coming out on Void Records, Void Digital Music, in early around February. And I'm going to be in the Winter Music Conference this year. I've got about 6-7 gigs down there this year. And on March 31st, I will be DJing at the Promised Land event, big event over in the UK on March 31st. So for my UK fans, I will be over across the pond on March 31st in the UK at the Promised Land Festival. And like I say, I got great music coming. I had a track called Hold On, which was Beatport Staff Pick of the Month back in December that I did with Trevor Mako. He's a hot male vocalist from South Africa, and I got a couple of new tracks coming up with Lady Legit. She's hot. She's from South Africa. I got another, I don't know why these singers, female singers call themselves Lady. I got Lady Hypnotic. Yeah, I got a track coming with Lady Hypnotic. It's going to be hot. So my hands are real full. I got a lot of remixes. I got a track coming out with Helen Mace that is going to be hot. I just got her vocals 2 days ago, so that's what I'm really working on right now. But I got a dynamic partner, which is called Daz Cube. Let me throw some props out to my man Daz Cube. He works with me. He does a lot of things with me on my production side. And if it wasn't for Daz, I don't know where I'd be at today. God bless me with him in my life. When I first met Daz, he was 17 years old. He was a little young kid. And the work he was doing, I was so amazed that he was so hot at what he do. He's really a trance guy, but he's this remarkable producer. He's hot, man. Don't forget his name. His name is Daz Cube. And that's just like my right-hand man. If it wasn't for him, I don't know where I'd be at today. I must thank God for that guy. But like I say, just be on the lookout for Void Digital Music. And don't forget my track out with Ian Campbell. Ian Campbell, cut track Wonder Why. And he also did a recover one of my songs, Don't Wanna Go. That both of those tracks are doing pretty well over in the UK. And that's my buddy, Ian Campbell. Hopefully he'll get these vocals to me soon because me and him got another track we're working on. So then I did a Frank Sinatra classic remake of Did It My Way. And Ian Campbell did two hot remixes of that track, and that'll be coming out soon on Void Digital Music also. I did a remake of Did It My Way, the Frank Sinatra classic. And Ian Campbell did two great remixes of that track. So be on the lookout for that. Got a lot of good music coming out this year from my label. And just from Chicago, period, with Kingdom Records, Kingdom and Legend Records, which are parent labels of my distributing company that I deal with here out of Chicago through Jerry King. And it's just wonderful. I mean, it's great. Yeah, I just I said this, which is just on the 15th of January. I just had me and my wife just celebrated our 8th year being married. So things are kind of good. My daughter's taking me to see Rihanna in March. So what else could a guy ask for?
Awesome. That's great, Sterling. Well, congratulations. And I know that if people want to reach out to you and check out your stuff, they can also find you on Facebook, facebook.com/Sterling Voice. So Sterling, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, hey, it was great. The opportunity was great. And keep up the great show. I love your show, Kelly.
Thank you very much. That's Sterling Void. And again, make sure to find him on Facebook, facebook.com/Sterling Void.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks to my guests, Robert Siciliano, John Gordon, Sterling Void, as well as our music editor, Sharon Hyland. Here is your inspirational quote of the day, this time coming from Brandon A. Treen. If your dreams don't have you reaching beyond your current capacity, they aren't big enough. Have an awesome week. Don't forget to check out our social media on Twitter at K Alexander Show, as well as on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/Kelly Alexander Show. Lots of great videos up there, as well as our new beauty tips, which we'd love for you to check out. It's a great video series. And also, we're starting a food series as well with cool recipes you can try. So check that out on our YouTube channel. And again, always on our website for cool blogs and pictures, KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have an awesome week. You and I'll chat soon.